So good evening, everyone, and welcome to Jum Yung, and welcome to this evening's talk titled Mindfulness, A Key to Happiness. So again, we've got 90 minutes this evening to look at this topic, and we're going to go through a few points. First, we're going to look at defining what do we mean by happiness. Then we're going to define mindfulness, because there's some confusion about that word as well. And then we're going to look at how mindfulness is a key to happiness. And then we're going to look at how to cultivate mindfulness to be able to strive for happiness. So there, and then time for some question answer at the end as well. So these are some of the points we'll be going through. So let's start by looking at this word, happiness. What do we mean by happiness? In fact, we can talk about two types of happiness. The first is often called temporal happiness. What we're talking about here, of course, is our experiences of pleasure. So this is often what we identify as happiness, is our pleasurable experiences. So that's one type of happiness. And the second type of happiness is what's called genuine happiness. The difference between these two is the first one, temporal happiness, is what's called a stimulus-based happiness, meaning we have some sort of stimulus and then we have some pleasurable happiness experience. That's why it's called temporal happiness. Whereas genuine happiness is a type of happiness that's not stimulus-based. It's a happiness that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. So this one is often what we identify as happiness, is simply we want more and more pleasurable experiences. Whereas the one that particularly we focus on in a Buddhist context is the second one, this state of genuine happiness. And this is a state of happiness or well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present for us to experience that. To strive for this state of genuine happiness, there are three elements that we need to cultivate. The first, and they're called the three higher trainings. So the first is ethics, effectively avoiding harming others, a non-harmful ethical lifestyle. On that basis, the second core element of the training is concentration, simply cultivating a calm, clear, focused mind. And then on that basis, the third element is the wisdom practice. This wisdom practice is to come to realize the nature of reality. Because from a Buddhist perspective, the reason, underlying source of our suffering is our distorted view of reality. So if we want to overcome our suffering and find this state of genuine happiness, we need to overcome our distorted view of reality through the wisdom practice. So these are the three core elements of practice that we need to engage in to strive for genuine happiness. So these are the two types of happiness that we're going to be looking at this evening. So we're going to look at how mindfulness is a key to both of these. That if we want to have either temporal or genuine happiness, then mindfulness is a key element striving for both of those types of happiness. And so that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. So before we look at that, how it's a key to happiness, we need to, of course, define what we mean by the word mindfulness. Mindfulness is a very popular term these days, but how mindfulness is defined in a lot of modern-day traditions is a little bit different than how it was originally defined within Buddhism. The word mindfulness is coming from the original Sanskrit word smriti or the Pali word sati. And both of these words literally mean to remember. So mindfulness is remembering. So how the word mindfulness is defined in Buddhism, we can go to a early Indian scholar, Buddha Ghosha, from about the 5th century, and he defines mindfulness. He says, mindfulness has the characteristic of remembering. Its function is not to forget. It is manifested as guarding. So in simple language, then mindfulness is the faculty of sustaining voluntary attention continuously on an object without forgetfulness or distraction. So it's our ability to hold or focus on an object without becoming distracted. So this is mindfulness, how it's originally defined within Buddhism, is remembering the object. Whereas in a lot of modern day traditions, it's defined a little bit differently. Often you'll hear mindfulness being defined nowadays as a non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. That's often how it's described. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that, but this is not really how it's originally defined. So this, in the modern tradition, is really talking about applying mindfulness in that way, whereas mindfulness originally is defined simply as remembering the object, the ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. And also, unfortunately, in some of the modern-day definitions of the word, we see this non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising. Again, it's very good to be non-judgmental of whatever is arising. But unfortunately, people misunderstand what that means, and they interpret or they think non-judgmental means don't evaluate anything, accept everything. This is a disaster. This is not mindfulness. So simply accepting everything and not evaluating whether something's beneficial or harmful is not mindfulness. And that's not the intended meaning of non-judgmental. So we need to keep that very clear in our mind. Now, here in our talk this evening, the title is Mindfulness, A Key to Happiness, not The Key to Happiness. Because again, often what we find these days is that mindfulness is taken out of context and is given as the whole solution. If we just develop mindfulness, everything will be fine. From a Buddhist perspective, that's not really going to work. Because we need to integrate mindfulness. We need to have a framework, particularly if we're talking about cultivating genuine happiness. So here, if we want to strive for genuine happiness, we need to integrate, we need to have this framework of three areas of practice. So we definitely need an ethical basis. The concentration practice is where we're actually cultivating, developing mindfulness. And then we apply that mindfulness in the wisdom practice. And also, together with the wisdom practice, we often have the other wing of practice, the compassion wing. So if we want mindfulness to be a key to happiness, we need to have an integrated approach. If we just simply strip out mindfulness and use mindfulness on its own, we're not going to be able to have
It's not going to be a key to genuine happiness. And what will happen is that in a lot of the modern traditions is mindfulness seems to be used as a way of trying to get more pleasure. But then, of course, we're not fixing up our elements of our life, our worldview and all these things. And actually what happens then is that mindfulness simply becomes a way of feeding our neurotic habits, feeding our greed, feeding our ill will, feeding our delusion. So rather than being a key to happiness, it becomes simply a way of getting more ingrained in our current habits. And so we don't really want that because it's not going to get us anywhere. Also, what we saw, those of you who were here last week, in the talk, I talked about a framework similar to this. We talked about those four elements of balance. And this was from a more sort of psychology perspective. But the first aspect was motivational balance, meaning to have healthy aspirations or desires for happiness. So if we don't have this, then of course we're not going to achieve any meaningful state of happiness. And then we have the second element, attentional balance, which is again developing our attention skills. So this is where mindfulness is actually cultivated in this element. But then on this basis, we engage in the other two elements of balance, cognitive and emotional. So again, if we want mindfulness to be a key to happiness, we need not just to engage in this practice, but we need to engage in all of these together. Because if we don't have healthy aspirations or desires for happiness, we're not going to achieve a goal. If we don't have cognitive balance, meaning if we're not seeing reality as it is, if we're distorting reality, we're not going to achieve happiness. And if we're emotionally unbalanced, of course, we're not going to achieve happiness. So we need to make sure that we have an integrated approach, then mindfulness can be a key to happiness. And so we're going to have a look at this evening how mindfulness is a key to happiness, assuming we have these elements within what we're doing. So let's have a look now at how mindfulness can be a key to happiness. So we talked about the two types of happiness, temporal happiness and genuine happiness. So let's see how mindfulness can be useful in striving for the goal of both temporal and genuine happiness. Because even though in a Buddhist perspective, the main goal is this state of genuine happiness, that's not at odds with temporal happiness or pleasure. So we're not somehow abandoning pleasure. It's not like a choice. Either I go for pleasure or I go genuine happiness. Pleasure or temporal happiness is actually the basis for genuine happiness. So we need to be using mindfulness as a key to striving for both. But of course, the longer term goal is the genuine happiness. So let's first see how mindfulness can help us in terms of temporal happiness or pleasure. Now, of course, in terms of temporal happiness or pleasure, what unfortunately we do is we often think or believe that these pleasurable experiences are going to fulfill us and satisfy us.
so we grasp onto these experiences as the source of happiness. So we grasp onto the pleasant experiences, hoping that they will give us happiness, and we try to avoid or push away the unpleasant experiences because we think they're the source of suffering. So actually what happens now is we tend to be stimulus reaction machines. We have a stimulus. If it's pleasant, we grab. If it's unpleasant, we push away. And that's generally how we tend to operate. If we are in this mode, it leads to a number of problems. The first is, we end up with attachment and aversion. Attachment and craving for pleasant things, aversion for unpleasant things. And this attachment and aversion often leads to a lot of suffering in our life. And secondly, we also then tend to identify or suppress our thoughts and emotions. So again, we tend to then, if some thought or emotion comes up, we tend to identify with it, follow it, get caught up in it. Or if it's some sort of unpleasant thought or emotion, we don't know how to deal with it, we try to suppress it. So identifying and following our thoughts and emotions and memories, or trying to suppress them, leads to a whole lot of problems. And we really become the slaves of our mind. We often become tormented and overwhelmed by our thoughts and emotions. So from this, we really end up as being the slaves of our mind, and also induces a lot of unnecessary suffering. And also, through this attachment and aversion, we end up engaging in quite inappropriate behaviour, which often leads to a lot of problems and suffering. So with all of these elements, they come from this stimulus reaction, you know, wanting good things, trying to push away unpleasant things. What we're going to do now is have a look at how, with mindfulness, we can avoid all of these things. We can really help to overcome these elements here, which lead to a lot of unnecessary suffering. So let's first look at how mindfulness can be a key in terms of here overcoming attachment to pleasant stimulus. So generally, if we have some sort of pleasant stimulus, we identify that with happiness, we try and grab it, we try and hold on to it. We have a lot of craving and attachment. So of course, when we have craving and attachment for pleasant stimulus, what happens is if we don't get it, we get frustrated. Even if we get what we're craving, it never really fully satisfies us. We simply end up craving for more. And often, if we have strong craving for this pleasant stimulus, then we often have a lot of fear and anxiety about not getting enough or losing it and so forth. And then also what happens, of course, is that if we have strong craving and attachment for something pleasant, unfortunately, that craving and attachment is always looking for something bigger, better, and different. Bigger, better, different. Which means if there's something now pleasant that we enjoy and we keep getting it, craving and attachment after some time goes, oh, that's boring. Give me something bigger, better, and different. So actually what happens is, not only don't we enjoy pleasant things because we're worried about not getting enough of it and losing it, but after some time, attachment goes, well, that's not interesting anymore. Give me something different. So actually we lose out on pleasurable experiences. So therefore, if we can cultivate mindfulness of pleasant stimulus, what's going to happen is that we are going to simply observe that pleasant experience without having attachment to it. So simply observing that pleasant experience, we can overcome attachment or reduce attachment. We can simply enjoy the experience while we have it, and of course then we won't have any frustration if we don't get it, and we won't have a lot of worry or anxiety about it not getting enough of it. So by simply having mindfulness, being present with our pleasant experiences, we can really reduce our attachment and craving for that pleasant experience. But also, of course, we're going to enjoy pleasures more. Because, again, if we can simply be present with our pleasant experiences, we won't have that craving and attachment, and we will simply be present and enjoy things more than we do now. And to really highlight that, I've got a very concrete example, which I think I used last week, but I'll mention it again here. And that was, some years ago, I went on my first long meditation retreat, solitary retreat. I was in Spain, I was on the side of a mountain, beautiful view out, all my meals were provided, very nice conditions. The meals, very healthy, but it tended to be the same menu every week. So even if there's some food you enjoy, but you keep eating it every week, then usually after some weeks you go, oh, not that again, even though originally you did enjoy it. My experience was that after about 4 or 5 weeks of eating the same food, I thought, wow, the cook's really putting a lot more effort into the cooking. It's tasting better now than it did at the start. And then a few more weeks went by, and then I realized, no, it's exactly the same food now as I ate a month or 6 weeks ago. What I realized was actually happening was, because I was cultivating mindfulness, my mind was calming down, my attachment and craving for pleasant stimulus was settling down, I was actually starting to enjoy the food. I was starting to actually taste the food, not sort of getting agitated about, is this good enough, or am I going to get enough of this? Am I going to really enjoy it or not? And so actually I started to enjoy the food more and more. Not only the food seemed to taste better, but everything around me seemed to be getting more beautiful. But again, it wasn't getting more beautiful. What was happening was, I was in a place, there was a beautiful view. But of course, if we're in a place with a beautiful view and we're living there day after day, week after week, month after month, after some time we just take it for granted. It's just like ordinary. Because attachment's always going, give me something bigger, better, different, bigger, better, different. And if it's the same, even if it's beautiful, after some time, attachment goes, that's just ordinary. Whereas my experience was, again, same view every day, things got more and more beautiful, or they seemed to. But again, what was happening is my attachment and craving for pleasant stimulus was settling down. And I was actually appreciating the things around me. And even tiny little things, normally which we don't even notice, I thought, wow, that's so beautiful. And so that was my experience. And that's what we can get. If we simply cultivate mindfulness and to be present with pleasant stimulus, we can simply reduce our craving and attachment for them, and we can actually enjoy pleasant experiences more than we do now. So this is how we can use mindfulness
in terms of, as a key for temporal happiness, in terms of simply enjoying pleasant experiences more than we do now. Let's see now how we can use mindfulness with regard to unpleasant stimulus. Now, of course, when we receive some unpleasant stimulus, we react with aversion. And all that happens is that when we react with aversion, what we do is we actually magnify the amount of discomfort we experience. So, and this was very much highlighted to me in a study that they did recently, where they had a medical study where they had a heat pad applied to the leg of people, and they had an intravenous drip in their arm, and initially they just had saline solution going in, and they asked people to give them a number of how much pain they had from 0 to 100. So on average it started off as 66, the average pain level that people monitored. And they kept telling them to keep telling them how much pain. What they did then after some time was they started, without letting them know, introducing painkiller into the drip. But they didn't tell them. But because of that, they started reporting average 46 instead of 66. But then what they did was they told them they were getting painkiller. So nothing changed, but they told that they were getting painkiller. So that went from 46 to 32. But then here's the point here. So it was at 32, they kept giving them painkiller, but now they told them they were going to stop the painkiller and to expect pain. It went back to 64. So simply having aversion to discomfort there magnified the amount of suffering they experienced. So this was a scientific experiment that they did. So if we have some unpleasant stimulus and we have aversion to it, all that's going to happen is we're going to magnify the amount of suffering we experience. So what we can do here then is, with unpleasant stimulus, is with mindfulness, is again simply be present. If we can be present with mindfulness in the unpleasant experience, we can stop having the aversion. And if we can do that, then we won't magnify the amount of discomfort we experience. So that's the first step, is simply through mindfulness, being present with unpleasant stimulus, we will not magnify the amount of suffering or discomfort we experience. We can practice what's called acceptance. But acceptance here doesn't mean resignation. Acceptance here simply means, currently I'm experiencing this unpleasant stimulus or unpleasant experience, I can either accept that fact or I can try to deny it or suppress it. But doing that, as we saw, just magnifies the amount of suffering we experience. So this is the first point we can use here, having mindfulness of unpleasant experiences. We won't magnify suffering. But on top of that, what we can do is use mindfulness as the basis of seeing that unpleasant experience not as a problem, but as an opportunity. Because actually, I think if we really look at our lives, the times when we most developed as a person was not when things were going well. Usually we just sort of float along and nothing, we don't develop. It's only when we're faced with something unpleasant, something challenging, that it forces us to develop. So if we can stop having aversion, then on that basis we can see this as an opportunity. That we can see this as an opportunity to develop as a person. that we can use this as an opportunity to develop perseverance and patience, for example. And then on top of that, we can use this as an opportunity to then develop empathy with others and compassion for others. So therefore, we can use unpleasant experiences based with mindfulness as opportunities for growth in our lives. So that's how mindfulness can also be helpful in terms of when we're faced with unpleasant experiences. Of course, if we have no mindfulness, we just have aversion, we see it as a problem, we suffer even more than we induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. So this is how to use mindfulness with unpleasant stimulus. Now we'll look at, remember back here, we said that often we identify with our thoughts and emotions and we end up with a lot of unnecessary suffering because of that. So let's see how we can have mindfulness of our thoughts and emotions, how that can help. So again, what we tend to do now is that one of two things when a thought, emotion, or memory comes up in our mind. Most often, of course, when a thought, emotion, or memory comes up in our mind, we identify with it, we follow it, we get caught up in our stories, and often we get overwhelmed by our thoughts, emotions, and memories. So we really are the slaves of our mind. Also, what we tend to do now is if something unpleasant comes up, an unpleasant thought, emotion, or memory arises in our mind, often we don't know how to deal with it. So what do? We suppress it. We try and stuff it back down. So both getting caught up, identifying with thoughts and emotions and memories, and getting caught up and trying to suppress them leads to us being really the slaves of our mind. Because when we try to suppress these negative thoughts, emotions, and memories, that's not dealing with them. What happens is they often manifest as a lot of physical problems in the body, and then we project a lot of this negativity onto the people around us. So, therefore, both identifying with our thoughts and emotions or suppressing them leads to a lot of unnecessary suffering. So here, of course, if we can simply develop mindfulness of thoughts and emotions as they arise, we're going to overcome a lot of this unnecessary suffering. Because now, so the first thing is by simply observing thoughts and emotions and memories as they arise, we won't identify with them. Because whenever we identify with thoughts and emotions and memories and we get caught up in them, they often really then just overwhelm us. For example, if we have some anger arising in our mind, often what we do, of course, is we identify with that anger. And we unfortunately have that in our language as well. Usually if some anger is coming up in our mind, what do we say or think? I am angry. So we've just identified ourselves with anger. So all we've really done there is we've said, there you go, anger, you're the boss, away you go. And then, of course, we get overwhelmed by our anger often. Same goes with jealousy, all other mental afflictions. We identify with them and we get overwhelmed. And so, of course, then... if we identify with these thoughts and emotions, you know, I am angry, we often then also say, I'm an angry person, that's me. So of course, if we identify with these and we say, I'm an angry person, I'm a hopeless person, I'm a lazy person, then of course we're going to feel stuck, we're probably going to suffer from a lot of low self-esteem and self-hatred. So these are sorts of things can happen if we don't have mindfulness and we identify with our thoughts and emotions. If we develop mindfulness of our thoughts and emotions, then rather than identifying with these things,
then we can simply be observing them. So when anger is arising, rather than identifying, I am angry, we'll be able to observe that anger arising with mindfulness and simply see there is some anger arising in my mind. And then anger is an object. Because when we identify with anger or any other thought or emotion, they become the subject. I am angry. I am an angry person. It becomes the subject. Whereas with mindfulness, we can observe these mental events as objects, which is what they are. A thought is an object in our mind. An emotion is an object in our mind. A memory is an object in our mind. So with mindfulness, we can observe them in that correct way. Then they can't overwhelm us, because a thought, emotion, or memory in itself has no power. It can't do anything to you. It can only do something to you if you give it power. And you give it power by identifying with it or trying to suppress it. So if you can develop mindfulness and simply observe these thoughts, emotions, and memories as they arise in your mind, then they have no power. They can't do anything to harm you. And of course, every time you identify with a thought, emotion, or memory, you are feeding it. So the habit of this stuff coming up will get stronger and stronger and stronger. Whereas if we have mindfulness of thoughts, emotions, and memories, we're not feeding them. So the habit of this stuff coming up will get weaker and weaker and weaker. Our mind will naturally become quiet and still. And we're going to, instead of being the slaves of our mind, being tormented by our mind, we're going to become the masters of our mind. So simply by developing mindfulness of things like thoughts and emotions, then we won't identify with it, and as a result, instead of being the slaves of our mind, we're going to be the masters of our mind. And similarly, we won't need to suppress them, because now, when something unpleasant comes up, we often don't know how to deal with it. We don't know what to do with it, so we stuff it back down. But again, suppressing these negative thoughts, emotions, and memories is not resolving them. They just often manifest as physical illness, and then we project a lot of negativity onto others. So simply being mindful of them, simply arising and passing, then simply acknowledging them, not identifying with them, is a great healing. Because we're not suppressing, we're acknowledging these, but because we are mindful of them, they have no power over us. We can simply acknowledge them, arise and pass, and we can let them go. So this is a very much a healing practice. And unfortunately in our modern society, there seems to be an epidemic of this suppressing of these negative mental events. Now, unfortunately, of course, there are a number of modern therapies which acknowledge that suppressing thoughts, emotions, and memories is harmful. It's not good. But unfortunately, a lot of these therapies, as a way of overcoming that, simply go to the other extreme of expression. You know, some of the, for example, anger management therapies say, don't suppress your anger. Of course, we shouldn't. But then the solution is express your anger, which is tantamount to identifying and following your anger. So you've just flipped from one extreme to the other. So from a Buddhist perspective, that's not a solution. Because every time you express the anger, okay, maybe they say shout at a wall or hit a pillow or something. Maybe today you're doing that, maybe tomorrow it's someone, you're smashing someone's face because you're in the habit of expressing anger. So that's not the solution to suppressing. We don't need to express to overcome suppression. All we need to do is mindfulness, is simply observe thoughts and emotions arising. We don't need to express them, just observe them arise and pass. And that is overcoming the suppression without expression. So mindfulness of thoughts and emotions is really a very good tool to become the masters of our mind. It's a healing practice to to overcome being the slaves and being tormented by our minds. Because our mind can either be our worst enemy or our best friend. Without mindfulness, often it tends to be our worst enemy, tormented by our mind. With mindfulness, it can become our best friend. So this is how mindfulness can help us with things like thoughts, emotions, and memories. Now, the other point now is then in terms of behavior. So we saw that before with our stimulus reaction habits, we often end up engaging in very inappropriate behavior that leads to a lot of problems and suffering for ourselves and people around us. So let's see how mindfulness can help us with our behavior. So again, often what we do, of course, is now we're not mindful of our behavior, and because we're this stimulus reaction machine, when we receive some sort of stimulus, what we tend to do is automatically react out of habit. And often our habits that we've developed are from attachment and aversion. So often our habits are not very constructive. They often are based on a lot of attachment and aversion, anger, jealousy, and so forth. So often our behavior is quite inappropriate and often quite harmful to ourselves and others. So again, here, then, if we develop mindfulness, how that can help us with behavior, of course, is that we can, with mindfulness, we can become ethical. Meaning to be mindful of any behavior that we're about to engage in or that we're currently engaging in. So therefore, with mindfulness, we can avoid reacting in a very harmful, inappropriate way. We can notice that if we're about to react, then we can catch ourselves and stop reacting in that very harmful way. But also, of course, mindfulness here can help us to, like the thoughts and emotions, to not identify with our behavior. Because similarly here is we tend to identify with our behavior. Just like thoughts and emotions, like when anger comes up, we often identify with that and go, I am angry. But likewise, in our behavior, we tend to identify ourselves with our behavior. For example, if we've done a harmful action, often we simply say, I am a bad person, don't we? Don't we often think that way? You know, if we've done something harmful, I'm a bad person. So what we've done there is we have identified ourselves with our behavior, our bad behavior, and we see ourselves as a bad person. So this is going to lead to a lot of problems for ourselves, because if we see ourselves as a bad person, then of course we're going to have low self-esteem. Of course we're going to attack ourselves and think bad about ourselves, because I'm a bad person. And it's going to be very difficult to have forgiveness or compassion for ourselves, because we feel we don't deserve it. I'm a bad person. I don't deserve forgiveness or compassion. And in fact, we often feel like it's not appropriate to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person. And if that bad person happens to be ourselves, then we don't have kindness and compassion for ourselves, and we beat ourselves up. We have low self-esteem. So with mindfulness, we can avoid this identifying ourselves with our behavior. And simply with mindfulness is acknowledge, rather than I am a bad person,
with mindfulness to simply acknowledge I have done a bad action or harmful behavior. So with mindfulness, we can simply acknowledge that. And if we do it like this, then we won't have low self-esteem. We can still feel good about ourselves, but at the same time address our harmful negative behavior. So we can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves and at the same time address and not accept our own bad behavior, regret our bad behavior and look at ways of overcoming it. Whereas if we do this, it almost becomes impossible to do that and it doesn't feel like it's right, and therefore we suffer also from low self-esteem. So here also is the difference between guilt and regret. If we've done something harmful and we feel guilty, what are we doing? I'm a bad person. Guilt is, I'm a bad person. We feel guilty. So guilt is coming from a false perspective. In fact, there's no such thing as a bad person. A bad person doesn't exist. Because there are two elements here. There's the person and behavior. What we've done here is we've fused the two together. We've made them one thing. So technically speaking, there's no such thing as a bad person. There's only people who sometimes do bad behaviors. So if we see the correct perspective, then we won't have guilt. If we see I have done a bad behavior, then instead of feeling guilty, which simply paralyzes us and doesn't help in any way, it just makes us feel bad, instead, if we have mindfulness and simply not identify with our behavior and simply see, I have done something, a bad behavior, then instead of feeling guilty, we can have regret. We can have regret for that negative behavior and look at ways of overcoming it. So that's the difference between regret and guilt. Guilt is based on a false perspective and it doesn't help anything, it just makes us feel bad. Regret really comes through mindfulness and not identifying with our negative behavior, and that is something very healthy. If we have regret for our negative behavior, we can look at ways of overcoming our negative behavior and at the same time have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. So with mindfulness, we're going to avoid a lot of these things. So if we're mindful of our behavior, we're going to avoid guilt, low self-esteem, self-hatred. And instead, we're going to have good self-esteem, we're going to have compassion for ourselves, and we're going to be addressing our bad behavior. So this is what we can do in terms of using mindfulness in terms of our behavior, is to not identify with it. Similarly, we can use the same thing with other people, mindfulness and their behavior. Because again, what we tend to do is, without mindfulness, if someone's behaving in a bad way, what we do is we automatically react and go, there's a bad person, don't we? Don't we often do that if they're behaving badly? That's a bad person. We're doing this. If we do this, we're in trouble, because in any given situation, we've got two choices, accept or reject. If someone's behaving badly, normally we reject. But if we do this and we reject, what do we end up effectively doing? We end up attacking the person, don't we? We get angry at them, we attack them. Or, if we understand that attacking the person and getting angry is not the right thing to do, the only other option is accept. So if we don't want to reject, we accept. But if we do this and we accept, what do we end up doing? We end up accepting their bad behavior, which is also not helpful. So we're stuck in this dilemma of either end up attacking the person or accepting their bad behavior if we identify them with their behavior.
So this, of course, is a problem. You know, either of those is not helpful. And then, of course, if we do this and it comes to forgiveness and compassion, you know, we often hear we should have forgiveness or compassion for people. It's a good thing. But if we do this, that becomes nearly impossible. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. But if we do that, then we're stuck. We can't. Forgiveness or compassion doesn't feel right. But the problem is not that we shouldn't have forgiveness or compassion. The problem is this. So if we stop doing this, if we have mindfulness and simply see there's a person who is behaving in a bad way, then we don't have this problem. Because we can reject the behavior and accept the person. We can have forgiveness and compassion for the person, but at the same time, not tolerate their negative behavior and be very forceful about that, not accepting that negative behavior. So therefore, if we have mindfulness, we have this correct perspective, then forgiveness and compassion becomes easy, and at the same time, we will not accept their bad behavior and we'll do whatever we can to stop that negative behavior, to help that person to overcome the negative behavior. So again, if we have mindfulness in terms of behavior, in others' behavior, we're going to avoid all of these problems, and it's going to be very constructive in terms of helping people to overcome their negative behavior. So that's a little bit how mindfulness can help us in terms of behavior, our own and others' behavior. So what we've seen so far then is that in terms of temporal happiness, then mindfulness is going to be very helpful, because in terms of pleasant stimulus, we're going to enjoy them more, we're not going to have craving and attachment for them. In terms of unpleasant stimulus, we won't have aversion, we won't magnify the unpleasant discomfort we experience. We'll be able to see unpleasant experiences as an opportunity for growth. In terms of our thoughts and emotions, then if we have mindfulness, we won't identify or suppress, in terms of we won't become the slaves of our mind, we won't be tormented by our mind, we'll become the masters of our mind. Our mind will become our best friend instead of our worst enemy. And in terms of our behavior, if we adopt mindfulness, we'll become much more ethical. We won't identify with our behavior and then end up with all sorts of low self-esteem, guilt, self-hatred issues, and also with the same with respect to others. So we can see how here, simply in terms of temporal happiness, how mindfulness can really be a big help to us. But of course, if temporal happiness or pleasure is our goal of happiness, then mindfulness can only take us so far, because we're still stuck in terms of temporal happiness or pleasure is never going to fulfill us. We're never going to find that state of lasting happiness. We're always going to continue to be subject to unpleasant experiences and suffering. So even though mindfulness can be very helpful in this regard, then if that's all we do, we're leaving ourselves a little bit short in what mindfulness can deliver to us. So what I'd like to do now is have a look at how mindfulness can be a key to genuine happiness. So again, here, when we talk about genuine happiness, we're talking about a state of happiness or well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. We're simply in the state of inner well-being, regardless of the stimulus. How to get into that state, of course, we need to understand what is obstructing that state of happiness. And so here, from a Buddhist perspective, if we investigate, we'll come to see that the source, underlying source of our suffering and the source of this state of genuine happiness lies within our own mind, not anything out there. So what we will come to, if we investigate, what we'll come to see is that it's our mental afflictions, things like anger, jealousy, craving, fear, anxiety, these mental afflictions are really the source of our suffering. And if we eliminate these mental afflictions from our mind, then there's no longer a source for suffering. And then we can be in that state of genuine happiness, that of not reacting to stimulus, of simply being in that state of inner well-being. So how to achieve that state is, from a Buddhist perspective, our mental afflictions are coming from our distorted view of reality. It's our mistaken way of seeing how we exist and the world around us exists. This is what's leading to our distortions of attachment, aversion, and so forth. In fact, to keep it very simple, it's this sense that there's a me here and an independent objective world out there. That is the problem. Because if we see this subject-object duality, there's a me here and an independent world there, then automatically we go into this, I want the good stuff that seems to be there, and I don't want the bad stuff or the unpleasant stuff that seems to be there, that seems to be causing me suffering. So from that apparent subject-object duality, we end up with this attachment, aversion, and then all of our other mental afflictions, jealousy and craving, they all come out of this initial reaction. So if we are to achieve a state of genuine happiness, we need to overcome this distorted view of reality and thereby overcome all our mental afflictions. How to do that? We're through those three areas of practice I mentioned at the beginning. The first was ethics. Is to have an ethical lifestyle. So here, of course, mindfulness is going to be key. Because here, with mindfulness, as we saw just now, if we are mindful of our behavior, we can avoid engaging in harmful behavior. And also here, if we have mindfulness, we can be mindful of the things we need to avoid in the future and the things we need to engage in. So if we have mindfulness of the harmful actions to avoid and the beneficial actions to engage in, then it's going to make it a lot easier to develop an ethical lifestyle as a basis. So a key element of developing this ethical lifestyle, of course, will be mindfulness. And then in the second core area, of striving for genuine happiness is concentration. So actually this practice is where we actually cultivate mindfulness. This is the practice where we strengthen our faculty of mindfulness. Because in the concentration practice, we are cultivating a calm, clear, focused mind. Because we need this practice, we need a calm, clear, focused mind if we want to come to penetrate the nature of reality. If we want to come to realize how things exist, we need a very calm, clear, focused mind to do that. Which is the wisdom practice, which I'm going to talk about shortly. So in order for us to realize the nature of reality, we need this very stable, clear mind. And this is actually where we develop mindfulness directly. Because the main tool in this concentration practice is mindfulness. So in this concentration practice, we are cultivating or developing a calm, clear, focused mind. So actually in this concentration practice, there actually are three qualities we're trying to develop.
In this concentration practice, we are trying to develop these three qualities of relaxation, stability, clarity. We are to have a basis of a relaxed mind. We are then trying to stabilize our mind, meaning to be able to focus on an object without becoming distracted, and then to be able to focus on it in a very clear way. So the two main tools we're using in this concentration practice is mindfulness and introspection. So here, again, mindfulness is our ability to focus on the object without becoming distracted. So this is the primary tool. So what we're doing in this concentration practice is we are strengthening our mindfulness. Because now our mindfulness is not very well developed. Of course, with all of these other, we looked at the previous in terms of the temporal happiness, to be mindful of our behavior, to be mindful of our thoughts and emotions, to be mindful of pleasant and unpleasant stimulus. And we try to do that, but the reality is, of course, we try to do that, but it doesn't work very well, does it? Because our mindfulness is very poorly developed. So even though mindfulness is a key element, even in terms of achieving some sort of temporal happiness, if we don't develop mindfulness, then of course, to actually be mindful of our thoughts and emotions and our behavior and be mindful of pleasant and unpleasant stimulus is going to be very difficult, isn't it? Because something's going to happen and we're going to react. So it's all well and good to say, be mindful of this, be mindful of pleasant and unpleasant things, be mindful of your thoughts and emotions, be mindful of your behavior. It's all well and good to say that, but when it comes to actually trying to do that, if you've ever tried to do that, it's not easy, is it? Why? Because our mindfulness is very poorly developed. And unfortunately, our modern day society, the way our society is structured, is crucifying our mindfulness. Our mindfulness is actively being degenerated through all of this bombarding of stimulus in our modern society. We're all over the place. So on top of normal lack of development of mindfulness, unfortunately our modern society seems to be making our mindfulness even worse. So we tend to be at a very poor level. So therefore, we need to strengthen our mindfulness. How best to strengthen mindfulness is this concentration practice. Is to simply focus in meditation on an object. So in this concentration practice, of course, what we're doing is we're focusing on a single object. And there's any one of many things we can focus on in this practice. Probably the most common one that's recommended is the breath. And some of you who've done this sort of practice probably have done this sort of practice, you know, mindfulness of breathing, focusing on the rising and lowering of the abdomen or focusing at the nostrils here. So any of you who've done any of this mindfulness practice, concentration practice, have probably been introduced to that. This is the most common object to use. But based on what we've been talking about this evening, another object that can be very helpful to support us in the earlier practices is to look at our own mind. So in this meditation practice, instead of observing the sensations of the breath, is simply observe your own mind. Observe your own mind and observe thoughts, emotions, memories as they arise and pass. Because remember, before, that's what we're trying to do in daily life. Instead of getting caught up in them, instead of being the slaves of our mind and tormented by our mind, in daily life, to help us is to simply observe thoughts, emotions, and memories as they arise and pass. But of course, if we haven't developed that habit in meditation, I think you can try as much as you want in daily life, you're not going to get very far. So here, in meditation, with a very relaxed body, and hopefully a more stable and clear mind, then we can start to get in the habit of observing thoughts, emotions, and memories as they arise and pass in meditation. And once we strengthen our mindfulness in meditation, particularly here with focusing on the mind, then in daily life, when we want to observe our thoughts, emotions, and memories, we have some ability because we've been training this in meditation. Our mindfulness is stronger, and we already have the habit of observing thoughts, emotions, and memories in meditation without reacting to them, without identifying, without suppressing. So if we do this practice, this meditation practice, particularly here, observing the mind, not only are we strengthening our mindfulness, but we're strengthening our habit of not getting caught up in these mental events. So I think for many of us in our modern society, we really do tend to be the slaves of our mind. So if we engage in this concentration practice, observing the mind, not only are we going to strengthen mindfulness, which is essential for everything we do in life, but also helpful in daily life in terms of observing our mind. So therefore, probably one of these objects is going to be the one that we would use in this practice that could be most helpful. So if we can really strengthen this mindfulness in daily life and in the meditation, and introspection here is the other tool. Introspection, so mindfulness in this practice is simply holding the object, focusing on the breath or the mind, not becoming distracted. Introspection is quality control. Introspection is monitoring the mindfulness. How are we going? Are we still holding the object, or are we getting distracted or dull? And then introspection is to notice when we've become dull or distracted, and if we have, then to reapply mindfulness. So actually here, the principal tool is mindfulness, and the more we develop that, the better introspection becomes automatically. So again, the key tool here is mindfulness. And this is where we can best develop, cultivate mindfulness in meditation, in this way. Then we can apply this mindfulness in daily life in terms of the temporal happiness. And also here, we can apply this mindfulness or use this mindfulness in our wisdom practice. The wisdom practice is to come to realize the nature of reality. Because now, from a Buddhist perspective, we don't understand the nature of reality. We misunderstand. We believe that there's an independent me and an independent objective world there. Now, here, we need to come to realize how things exist, not just intellectually understand. Because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. If it was, a lot of our problems would be sorted. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits, and our instinctive habits is out of sync with reality. Like a simple example in this regard, in terms of the wisdom practice, is the idea of impermanence. You know, the idea that things are changing moment by moment. I think we all intellectually accept that, don't we? Science has proven it. We learned it at school. I think none of us have a problem with the idea that everything is changing moment by moment. But is our behavior driven by that understanding? No. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habit is telling us this cup is the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. That's how we relate to this cup, as if it's somehow stable, don't we? Is that how it really exists? No. We know that intellectually. We know intellectually that there's no stable cup here. We know intellectually that this is changing in every given moment. But our behavior is not driven by that intellectual understanding. That's the problem. Our behavior is driven by our false instinctive habit.
The instinctive habit that says this is stable. It's more or less the same here yesterday, same tomorrow. And from a Buddhist perspective, then, we are out of sync with reality, and because of that, we have mental afflictions and suffering. So, therefore, in the wisdom practice, it's not just about getting a correct intellectual understanding of how things exist. What we need to do is to bring our correct intellectual understanding of reality into experience. We need to realize directly how things exist. To do that, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need concentration. We need mindfulness. If we don't have very highly developed mindfulness, there is no way that we're going to have stable enough mind to come to realize reality in meditation. So therefore, if we want to achieve genuine happiness, we need it to be mindful of ethical behavior. We need to develop mindfulness, strengthen it in the concentration practice, and then we need to use that strong mindfulness in our wisdom practice. But also, of course, in other practices, to really fully develop compassion, we need mindfulness to be able to really realize, to fully develop that. So we can see here that mindfulness is a key element in the wisdom practice, and without that, we're not going to find genuine happiness. So this is how mindfulness is also a key element in striving for genuine happiness. On that note, maybe I've said enough, so maybe we've still got 15 minutes left, so maybe if there's some questions anyone would like to raise regarding anything we've covered this evening. Yeah, see, this is the key is, again, is that the key is, you know, we're talking about here being mindful of emotions and thoughts and so forth. The problem now is, for us, our mindfulness is not very well developed. We don't do any of this concentration practice. Our mindfulness tends to be quite poor, which means that when something is coming up, let's take anger as the example, we have to be at a sort of fairly already well-developed level before we realize we're angry. And at that stage, we're already out of control. You know, we're already out of control. And so then, what can we do? I mean, pretty well, the only thing we can do is cut from the stimulus that's feeding the anger. Of course, that's not a solution, but that's sort of the last-ditch thing, because we don't want to react from the anger. So if we're already out of control, what are we going to do? We really just need to step back and get out of there. So the key element here with mindfulness is not to get to that point, because anger doesn't come instantaneously. Sometimes it's quite quick, but there's always a build-up. That build-up may only be 1 second, but usually it takes a little bit longer. And so when anger comes up, usually it starts with a bit of tension in the body, maybe the breathing starting to get a little bit rough, maybe a bit of agitation in the mind. If we notice those markers, then we can go, hang on, what's going on here? Then we have a chance of observing, because we're still in control. But we can only pick those things up if we've developed mindfulness. So it's all well and good to say, I'm going to be mindful if I get angry, but the chances are we're probably going to explode, and then it's too late, we're out of control, what to do, we just need to get out of there. So again, if we really cultivate the mindfulness in the concentration practice, then what you're going to notice is that you're going to pick up that your body is getting a little tense, that your breathing is starting to get a bit rough, your mind is getting a bit agitated. Then you can go, oh, what's going on here? And then you can observe. And then you can be mindful of the tension in the body, agitation in the mind. And if you are mindful of it, then it can't go anywhere. It'll just pass. Because if you become mindful of, let's say, the agitation in your mind, you're not focusing on what's feeding the agitation anymore because you're looking directly at the agitation itself. So there's nothing feeding it anymore. So it can't go anywhere. It can't develop and it will pass. So that's the key, is if we strengthen mindfulness in meditation, we have this ability in that little window of opportunity before things get out of control to do something. If we don't, too late. Then not much to do. We just have to get out of the situation. So that's why if we don't meditate and strengthen mindfulness, simply in daily life saying, I'm going to be as mindful as possible, it'll help, but we won't get very far. Whereas if we meditate, this becomes instinctive. If we meditate, then you'll instinctively notice these things and instinctively just observe them pass. It won't be then even an intellectual thing. In fact, sometimes what you'll find is if you've developed mindfulness in meditation, sometimes you'll find, wow, that thing that used to irritate me doesn't seem to irritate me anymore. What's happening is that a little bit of irritation is arising, you're noticing it and it's passing. Yeah?
Sitting with it, but you can really feel the discomfort in your body, and it can then come out as an emotion, as in tears. So there's a release without getting into a thought journey with it. There's a release, but there's this need for a release,
right,
to let it go.
Yeah, right. And often you'll find that this release, and often it can come in terms of tears or so forth, is a good sign. It is you are seeing it and acknowledging it and letting it go. So, you know, yeah. But again, there's a difference between releasing and expressing and getting caught up. There's a big difference. Big difference. Yeah. So sometimes you're right. When we do that acknowledging and releasing, there can be a lot of physical things, you know, tears and a lot of things can happen. But they're usually a good sign because usually we're like this. And then when we release, then we often have a lot of things happening, but it's usually a very good sign.
Do you believe you can achieve mindfulness in every environment? Like some environments can be very negative, so you have a lot of stimulus of negativity. Or, you need to have a very strong mind, I guess. Or at that point, you just change the environment.
Right, yeah. So, of course, some stimulus are very strong and some not so strong. So, of course, as a beginner, our mindfulness is very poorly developed. So usually most stimulus, if it's pleasant, unpleasant, we just react and mess. So if we develop mindfulness and meditation, we're going to initially notice that we can pick up the things that are not too heavy. So to think that if we develop a bit of mindfulness, we'll be able to be very present with very heavy stimulus, that's unrealistic. So what you'll find is that the more we develop the mindfulness, the more we get in the habit of observing and not reacting, the more you'll find bigger and bigger and bigger we can be present with. If we want to have that at the highest level, then we need to start to go here. Because the primary reason we react to begin with is a false sense of me. You know, there's this me here that's being attacked, or, you know, we're holding on to this me, 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 me here. As long as we do that, then we're not going to be able to 100% get rid of reaction. With mindfulness, we can really bring it down to very acceptable levels. But if we want to get rid of reaction altogether, then we need to go here. And again, remember, mindfulness is the basis of this. So in the long term, to be able to be 100% present, no matter how strong the stimulus, we'll need to really end up going here. But in the short to medium term, then simply through strengthening mindfulness, we can start to be able to be present with not such strong, big stimulus and be able to deal with them. But that's why... that's why we need this integrated approach. You know, see, that's the thing, is a lot of mindfulness movements today take this out and they look at all these other elements and they go, oh, that's that religious stuff, you know, that ethics stuff and compassion. Well, that's that religious stuff. Let's get rid of that. And then they just strip out mindfulness on its own, and then it becomes quite ineffective. And actually, it can then, people use mindfulness to be more mindful about how to make more money and more, be more greedy and so forth. And that's a tragedy. That's a tragedy. And then it loses its efficacy. Whereas if we have a framework and mindfulness is in that framework, then we can really achieve a lot with mindfulness. So we need to, with this and related questions, we need to understand, if not, mindfulness on its own is never going to get us to that longer term result. We need to have all these elements around it. Then we can really go somewhere with it in a good way.
In education, you talk about when you're working with children to actually do what you're saying.
Sure.
Correct the behavior and not label them like that. Where do we get lost in translation when you are a child and
This idea here.
Meant to just talk to them in third person all the time?
Not third person, but like this instead of this. I mean, the thing is that our language is all this.
Yeah.
And that's what we've learned since we're this high. I mean, this is a tragedy. I mean, no wonder
we're... The teachers don't do that anymore.
Hmm?
The teachers don't do that anymore.
Well, I hope not. But, I mean, how often do you see if a little child is misbehaving, the parent or the teacher goes, bad girl, bad boy. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. Well, I hope they don't.
In education, and the first thing they were telling us, it was to correct the behavior and...
Exactly. So, yeah, exactly. So if we use this sort of language, then it's going to be very helpful to educate the children. So, you know, to use this sort of behavior language rather than this sort of language to the child. And also, like, it actually reminds me, when I was teaching something like this some years ago, there was a lady, and, you know, not just behavior, but thoughts and emotions, you know, I am angry. There was a lady in the class and she said that she had two very young children, 3 and 4. And she said when they used to get angry, rather than saying, you're angry, she used to say, look, there's that anger thing in your mind again.
Yes.
And it forced the child to look at anger as an object and to not identify with the child's anger. The child was like trying to look at this thing called anger. Yes. And she said it was very helpful to... Yeah, and that's what she said. She said it was very helpful to say, look, there's that anger thing in your mind again. And she said it was so helpful to help the child not identify with their anger and to see anger as an object, which it is.
Yeah.
It's not us. And so she said it was very helpful to say things like this, not instead of you're angry. Yeah.
Many of the modern mindfulness deliverers say that with the mindfulness practice alone, compassion and the positive qualities will develop because they're part of our innate nature.
Let's say that if you really develop mindfulness well, what you're going to find is that some of these other elements you may intuitively start to develop. But the reality is, as a beginner, you're not going to be able to fully develop mindfulness without attending to these other elements. You know, also in Buddhism, we hear the idea that, you know, when you realize the nature of reality, compassion will spring forth automatically. We hear that a lot. And so people think, oh, I don't need to develop compassion because all I need to do is realize reality and compassion will come automatically. That may be true, but what the fine print says is you're never going to realize reality unless you work on compassion now. You're never going to get there because we have so many bad habits now. So yes, it may be true that if we have fully developed mindfulness, maybe some of these things develop, but we're never going to get there if we don't develop these along with it. Because also, often people develop mindfulness for not very good reasons, and you know, these things will only develop if initially you have an idea of what mindfulness can take, where it can take you. So already you have some framework. And then if you really want that mindfulness to develop, you need to work on the other elements. Like, as I mentioned in last week's talk, we talked about these four elements: motivational, attentional, cognitive, emotional. Mindfulness is here. But if we don't attend to these now, we misunderstand reality now, we react with anger and jealousy now, we have not very good desires and motivations. If we keep those dysfunctional elements, they're going to sabotage this. We're not going to be able to develop mindfulness in any significant way. So yes, if we have full mindfulness, maybe these things get sorted out a bit, but we're never going to get there. So what you'll find is that each of these elements supports the other. So if you can now develop mindfulness and work on these other elements together with it, then when mindfulness becomes more strong, as you suggested, it's going to feed into these. And they will feed back in again, so that it'll be supporting each other. So you'll find that if you attend to these elements, you'll be able to develop mindfulness much more quickly, much more effectively. So that argument, I think, there is a small element of truth, but it's very misleading. It's the same with Buddhism. If you realize the nature of reality, compassion will automatically come. It's true, but then if you don't develop compassion now, you're never going to get to realize reality.
So what these people developing mindfulness to the corporate, to the banks,
No, it will have a positive effect, but again, it depends what the goal of that mindfulness is. Unfortunately, a little bit what I see is that sometimes corporations are using mindfulness to so that their employees work harder and more effectively for them so they can make more money.
Yep.
You know, is that really what we want to do with mindfulness?
I mean,
that's why in this model, this is the first element, is, you know, what are our aspirations and desires in life? If our desire and aspiration is to feel a bit more calm and make more money and enjoy more pleasure, then that's what's going to feed into the mindfulness. And if you use mindfulness, you may find that. You may find you're a little bit less stressed at work, a little bit more effective. And so you work longer hours to make more money to not be able to enjoy the house that you can now afford. I mean, is that really what you want to do with mindfulness? Okay, if that's what you want to do, okay. But I mean, Buddhism says, well, you're sort of cutting yourself a little bit short there, you know. You're using something potentially transformative for a very little thing, you know. If you integrate these elements, not only will your mindfulness become more effective and actually... then your original reason to be more calm, less stressed, more effective will happen more. But on top of that, you're going to be then enjoying the fruits of more genuine happiness as well. So it's a win-win situation. It's not like one or the other. It's not like I want less stress, more money, more pleasure, or I'll take this. If you take this, you get this as the byproduct in bigger quantities. Okay. Any other last questions? Yeah, last question, then we finish.
The meditations.
Yeah.
What do you recommend, like how long the meditations? Up about 20 minutes a day.
Yeah. So, So with the meditation, particularly this concentration meditation, the key phrase is quality over quantity. So it's much better to do this mindfulness meditation 20 minutes in a focused way than sit there for an hour allowing yourself to get dull and distracted, because then you're just weakening your mindfulness, in fact. So quality over quantity. And then, of course, like any training, as you become more proficient, you'll need to extend it. It's a little bit like going to the gym. You start, you go short sessions, low weights, and then you build up. Similarly here, if you just do 20 minutes, it's a start, but if you only keep doing that, like doing a short gym session, you're not going to really fully develop. So you'll need to then, over time, extend that a little bit and more. But again, the key also here is then what we do for the rest of the day. So not only are we developing mindfulness in meditation, but we're trying to apply mindfulness in daily life and further cultivate it in daily life. So if we just sit down and do this mindfulness thing for whatever, 20 minutes in the morning, but then we jump up and rush around like we normally do, mindlessly for 14 hours, which is going to be more strong, 20 minutes of mindfulness or 14 hours of mindlessness? So what we need to do for the rest of the day is keep working on the mindfulness. And here we can use modern technology to help us for a change instead of interfering. We can use actually our smartphones in a good way instead of a distracted, mindless way. Is there are plenty of apps that do this, these mindful apps, like one simple one, Mindfulness Bell. Program it to set off a bell at regular intervals through the day. When you hear the bell, you stop whatever you're doing and do a little mindfulness exercise. Maybe just focus on your breathing for 3 breaths. And you'd be surprised if you do that at regular intervals during the day, how you then start to become more mindful in the day. And that's going to feed back into your meditation, and that'll feed back into the daily life. So we need that both approach. If we just try to be mindful in the day, or we only meditate on mindfulness in the morning, we're not going to get very far. If we do both together, then we've got a chance of developing. Yeah. Okay. Better stop there. We've run over time. So the last point is, if anyone wants to know more about mindfulness and how to practice it, I have a lot of short talks and courses and retreats on my website. GlennSvensson.org, so you can help yourself to whatever you find on the website. There's plenty of audio materials and so forth on there. So this practice, this mindfulness practice in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions often is called shamatha practice. So on my website, that's what it's called, shamatha practice. It's one of my favourite types of retreats to lead, so I'll be leading some more of those in the coming year, so if you're interested, then come along. So thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed this evening.